including both visible and invisible disabilities. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Allison, if you just want to introduce yourself.
Hi there, my name is Allison. I am a...
Okay, good morning. You are listening to All Access Pass, and we're going to jump right into things today. I'm sitting with Michael Kingsmill, who is the project manager and design services for AMS. He was one of the primary architects for the AMS Student Nest and has worked on building projects on campus for quite a while now, over 30 years.
It is, yes.
Wow.
Great years.
Oh, shoot. And so your next project will also be the Art Student Center, if
that's
I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and we're also involved in the Student Life building, the old Student Union building that's getting repurposed. So we're right involved in that at the moment, and then off to the Art Student Center, yes.
Nice, lots of big projects underway, I can see. Is there anything else I forgot to elaborate on in terms of getting to know you?
Oh, I don't think so. I think you've covered it off. I'm delighted to be here and speak to a topic that's near and dear to us all, I think, with accessibility and inclusiveness and those kind of things for us at the campus here.
Yes. So this week's topic, we're going to be talking about living with disability in BC, specifically what makes living in this province specific to someone with a diverse experience in BC. And I thought, who else would be more fit to talk about the physical accessibility of buildings on campus. So I guess my first question, just jumping in, is so since working on the extension of the old sub, which was a while ago, what are some changes you have seen UBC make in terms of accessibility?
Oh, well, there's been certainly a lot. I was reflecting on this interview just a day ago and thinking back to the 1980s when really the campus was not so friendly for people with physical challenges. And in those days, and it started to actually, I was going to say, with Expo 86, the World's Fair that we hosted here in Vancouver, was really a time of fundamental change, I think, provincially and culturally, to include disability issues more in the forefront than really marginalized as they were before.
Right. So it was that kind of that international attention that kind of drew the city planning to become more accessible in a sense.
And I think it was also nationally it affected right. our national attitudes as well. And we see from post 86 big changes in terms of code requirements and things of that sort, and that's only gotten better through the ages.
And was that something you learned? Because I know you studied at UBC.
I did.
Yeah. Was that something taught in architectural studies, like accessibility, or was that something that that was eventually changing after the expo, and then you learned as you continued to grow in the profession?
Well, I think a bit of both. I had a great prof named Dr. Richard Seaton, and Dr. Seaton was very involved in accessibility, both for visual impairment and also from a physical standpoint. And he was retained as a consultant. I had the good fortune to work for him as a grad student on the Expo 86 accessibility plan. But I think in the school, I was actually, again, thinking back when we did our so-called accessibility piece in our architectural studies, we had to get in a wheelchair and spend the day in a wheelchair and roam around campus.
Right.
And thinking about that, you know, there were no curb cuts, there were very few accessible washrooms and all of these things and door swings, and really it was quite a challenge to get around. And I think that really kind of hit home that what these people actually go through in their day-to-day routines and the trials and tribulations of frustrations of just
right,
everything
right.
we sort of take for granted of being able to open a door.
Right.
And, you know, in those days prior to 86, it really wasn't their needs were not really considered. But post that time, I think we've made enormous strides.
So that was kind of like the big change in BC specifically.
I think that was the milestone moment that changed the whole thing around, yeah.
Nice. Okay, so just as usual, we broadcast live from the UBC AMS Student Nest. What were some of the challenges you had while constructing the nest, like a building of this size? A big project like this in terms of accessibility?
Well, accessibility now is built into the BC Building Code.
Right,
so it's something that is mandated by the regulations of the province. And the UBC falls under the BC Building Code,
right.
As opposed to the City of Vancouver, which has their own building code, which is, I must comment, is very much modeled under the provincial regulations as well.
Right.
But in the BC Building Code, all the sort of the regulations cover a whole array of items that we often don't stop to think about, things such as the door swings, the door hardware, the closing time of a door, if it's got an automatic closer on it, what the threshold is as you go from one floor material into another floor material. We have, for example, polished concrete floors on the main atriums, but then you go into areas where you have what we call sheet goods. So there's thresholds, and those thresholds have to be no more than a certain height so that there's not a kind of a bumper or something that would hinder the wheelchair from rolling over into the next The elevator cabs, the layout of the call buttons, you know, their height off the floor, their style. They have now also tactile symbols on them as well for people who are visually impaired. So there's really from top to bottom, there's a whole host of many, many things that we have to check off and make sure that we have compliant. As well, codes are really just minimal requirements. I think in respect to the disability pieces in the building code, they do go a bit above the normal everyday sort of minimum requirements. But I think when people design for these, I don't like the terms particularly, but special needs.
Right.
I think we tend to also make an emotional commitment to it.
Right, right.
You know, we try to go above and beyond. We make sure that it's not just minimal compliance. That and as an example, this studio in CITR
right.
Was an exercise in and of itself. The code doesn't tell us that this... not a DJ booth, but this interview studio.
Live studio, yeah.
Has to have all these certain things. But
right, right.
We did a full mock-up of this studio and made sure that we had the turning radiuses and everything for
right.
people who are confined to wheelchairs, you know, how they'll move in and how they'll get through the doors and all of those sort of things. So particular areas within the nest also have their own focus, CITR, some of our other program spaces. And throughout the building, we often think of, you know, people who maybe have motation limitations, but there are people who visual impairment, hearing, all of these sort of things. So we have fire alarm systems that operate on strobes, so people who have hearing impairment, they can be alert to fire alarm signals through visual recognitions. And so there's lots of different levels that we approach this, the needs of people with perhaps physical limitations and
right,
hearing
right.
visual movement.
Yeah, I see there's a lot of work that goes into it, and I know I can speak on behalf of our accessibility collective that we really appreciate the work that goes into and all the considerations that go into that. Were there any like specific things looking at the old sub that you were like, okay, this for sure needs to be changed when we moved into the new sub in terms of accessibility, maybe the elevators, the stairs? Was there anything that stuck out that you were like, okay, we need to improve for the new building?
Well, I hate to answer the question with a no, but the new building code, the BC Building Code, BCBC as it's called, is extremely thorough.
Right.
And they cover, as I mentioned, some of the things like the door swings, the curb heights, the steepness of ramps, the food service lineups, is there accessibility to the counters at the food service outlets, the elevator cab, how it's all laid out, where's the buttons at what height off the floor, handrails, a big one, and on and on. So I think actually we can really use the code as a checklist to go through it and make sure we have compliance in all these sort of things. The code also is not only just words, but it is also supplemented with a handbook I think it's 136 pages of
mm-hmm.
Graphic representations of various requirements for the design of certain things, you know, within the bathroom stalls for disability accessible requirements. What is the distance between the partitions? What is the door operating device? So it really is, I think, very well covered now in the building code. And we have within the building code, it's constantly under review. And every 5 years, it also comes under a mega review. And there are people who are within the department that are just in the accessibility kind of side of the building code. So they spend a lot of time with various agencies in Vancouver and in the province here finding out, you know, what are the new challenges that they face, you know, as we can never stop, right?
Right,
everything becomes a bit of a learning curve for us of something else. But I think right now I must compliment the code and its thoroughness. Yeah, it's very, very good document.
For sure. It seems like that's the case. And so we're just running out of time here. But the last thing I wanted to ask is what kind of changes do you see are happening or can you see in the future in terms of accessibility on UBC campus or just built, for example, the building codes in BC in general?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm not sure about specifics within the building code, because as I mentioned, it's constantly being readdressed. But one thing I think we would like to see more of is for people who have hearing needs. You know, many of our rooms up here, we have audio aids, but I think I'd like to see more of those. We don't have them universally throughout the building.
Right, in the nest.
I was going to say in the nest. In our bookable rooms, we're quite good, but in our sundry areas, we're probably... it's not a code deficiency, but I think that we could
just out of a personal consideration,
something that we could probably look in the future to maybe provide more of those kind of cues for hearing aids. As you know, when you chime in on various phone devices, you can go to an audio read on it. So I think that's one area that I think we could see some improvements on.
Oh, awesome. That's great. And thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, well, I'm happy to
be here. Talking to you and getting a better idea of kind of what goes into the building of making the building process of making sure something is accessible for someone with a diverse ability. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And I also appreciate the work and the past work you've done in terms of considering and making sure buildings are accessible for students with disabilities and people with disabilities who have to navigate campus. Right. So thank you so much for coming
in.
My
pleasure. And I'd also like to just put in a little plug for the university. I think that it was also should be acknowledged that the university has also taken the high ground on these issues too, through their campus planning department and some of their employees who are specialized in this area are constantly reviewing drawings that are part of the new project review and making sure that there's adherence to the compliance. And so UBC also is also stepping up to the plate and doing a great job there as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So now we're going to hear a song by Dalla. This is Life on Earth.
Trying to paint a masterpiece, but I've been coloring all the wrong things. We all fall down and skin our knees. Just keep running, let it bleed, 'cause you're all happy or hold your hand, and I don't wanna be
Okay, hi, we are back. This is All Access Pass. On our show, we speak on issues and topics surrounding accessibility on and off UBC campus. The content of this show is thanks to the amazing work of the Access Collective volunteer team. I am Desi, I am the coordinator of the Access Collective, and you were just listening to Michael Kingsmill, who was the director and primary architect of the AMS Student Nest. So this week we're going to be talking about what makes the personal lived experience of a person with disability in BC, what makes it specific to BC. So we're just going to head off that with an interview which was pre-recorded with a personal friend of mine. Her name is Allison, and she is a fifth year GRSJ student, and we're just going to play that right away here. Hey, Allison. Allison, if you just want to introduce yourself.
Hi there. My name is Allison. I am a fifth-year student here at UBC, and I am a GRSJ major, which stands for Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice, and kind of the on-campus activism that I'm involved with is that I am the president of the Gender Studies Undergraduate Student Association.
Yeah, and a very great one at that.
Thank you. I think, first of all, it's important for me to say that so the disabilities that I have are invisible disabilities, and I'm able-bodied, but I have quite a bit of chronic pain, so I think that's a really interesting intersection there in the fact that, like, physically, I can access all spaces and that, like, I can walk, and the fact that I'm able-bodied, but my chronic pain I have as a result of scoliosis makes it difficult for me to be in some spaces, if that makes sense.
Right, right. So how do you find your experiences as someone with a disability? Invisible disability, like how is it different from having a physical or visible disability for you?
Well, I can't exactly maybe fully answer that because I don't have a physical or like a visible disability. Right. I guess anyway, I do have a physical disability because I have scoliosis and that manifests as chronic pain in my body. But the fact that I don't have a visible, quote unquote, physical disability as like someone who uses a wheelchair or like a mobility device. But that's not to say that my disability or disabilities rather don't affect me on an everyday basis. So for example, I kind of count this as a disability in the fact that I have anxiety. And I know for a lot of people that is kind of like a blurry line of whether or not to count mental health as a disability. But for me, in a way, I do, especially in a university context wherein we're expected to do, like, students are just burdened with so much work, right, and to an extent that I think is quite often unreasonable a lot of the time, we're just told to, like, suck it up, like, don't have that mental breakdown, just, like, suck it up and, like, study for that exam so you can go and write that exam and do well on that exam. Or, so there's, in that sense, there's not really much, I think, space for students to express anxiety or depression. And I think because so much is expected of students, having anxiety or depression, which can really affect your schoolwork and your ability to do schoolwork, can be very disabling to get that work done.
Right. That's also super important as we head into, like, crunch week and now, what, we have two more weeks until exams. How do you find accommodating exams?
So I am registered with Access and Diversity, and the kind of the most help and how I utilize my accommodations through them is I have exam accommodations, so I'm able to go write my exams with them in their offices. So during, I guess, midterms, that's in their offices in the basement of Brock Hall, and then during finals, they have an entire couple of wings of Buchanan D blocked off just for students writing their final exams. And so I have the ability to have my own setting, my own room, and extended time. And, like, if I didn't have that accommodation, like, I honestly don't think I would be able to survive university and if I didn't have those exam accommodations. No, UBC is not accessible enough. Like, just straight up answer, no. But I think that's, like, there we go, institutionalization of academia and knowledge production through the creation of the university, and the fact that kind of not just on a disability accessibility level, but overall, like, university is, like, so inaccessible. And that's not just a problem that UBC has, like, at the core fundamental of all universities. I think it's a huge problem that, like, university as, like, a construct is very inaccessible.
Right.
But, like, bringing it back to, like, just the UBC contact. And, like, another thing is, like, our campus is physically ginormous.
Yeah. Like, I didn't even think of that, that it's just hard to get around in general because it's just huge.
And, like, so this is actually going to tie in. This story does have a purpose right now. But this semester, I'm actually doing, like, a self-directed course disability.
Nice.
And I've been looking at it from, like, a bunch of lenses, so from, like, a race point of lens, but, like, race, gender, parenthood, like, reproductive rights and disability, and just in, like, general theory, like, basis level theory of disability, in terms of, like, talking about the social construction, the biomedical construction, and then, like, different constructions that combine the social and biomedical. And one of the theorists I've read proposed this really interesting theory, and this is getting to the point now, when he talked about the idea of crip time. And first of all, he, like, theorized the idea of notion of time. So it was a pretty, like, theoretical, like, mind-blowing article when he talked about how, like, time is a social construct.
Right.
And when people who have disabilities sometimes need more time to do, like, everyday tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, wherein he calls this, like, crip time. Crip is in CRIP. And bringing back to the notion of UBC being a gigantic campus, just, like, physically walking from one class to another might take one student, like, a longer time than someone else. And
Right. The
notion of crip time, that some people with disabilities just need more time to, and sometimes you only have 10 minutes to get from one class to the next. Like, sometimes that's not even enough time for someone who's not disabled.
Right.
And who's, like, physically, like, able-bodied, who doesn't have chronic pain, who's, quote-unquote, like, a normal person, quote-unquote, like, a good body, what have you, or is, like, I guess, physically abled, right? And what does that mean for students who have disabilities, who need a mobility device to get from point A to point B who have chronic pain like myself, and sometimes movement on one day can be easy, but the next day is more difficult. So a way that might make campus more accessible is having more time between class periods. So,
right.
Like, but that's like a whole institutionalized thing that like the entire university would have to adapt and like entirely change its course structure. But I would argue that that's worth it because in that sense it will make the university more accessible. And then like another kind of everyday basis, like having more comfortable chairs in classrooms.
Anyway, go on, yes.
Like some classes, like a lot of my classes are in Buchanan, and the desks and they just suck. Like the ones that have the chair and the desktop is pretty much just designed for like a specific idealized body,
right,
that's like slim and able-bodied, but like people with variations in the bodies, different shapes, different sizes, different abilities, what have you, like those desks, in all honesty, only really work for a small number of people. And I would argue, like, after a while of sitting in that desk, anyone's body would hurt.
Right, right. I think, yeah, we were I was talking with someone else about how, like, the UBC, well, not UBC, but the university in general is built for a very stereotypical idea of a body in mind. And, yeah, something like sitting down, or we were even talking about we were talking to the president of the UBC Disabled Student Association, Eugenia, about how, like, even access to plugs in the older buildings, they're like super spread out, or you have to go to the front of the class. And a lot of people, students with disabilities, really rely on software to help them with their learning process. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole issue.
The idea of like a desk that you sit in, for someone with, like myself who has chronic pain, who like after even like a hour lecture sitting in an uncomfortable chair can put me in a huge amount of pain that can last with me for the rest of the day, if not into the next day or two. Like, that's really upsetting, and that makes it really difficult for me to be able to engage in my classes and engage with academia. And it's like, I would argue it's like the little things like that. It's the little things like that can make a really big difference. And like, obviously the university is going to argue that's not really a little thing, because they were upfront, it will cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
For the university to go in and put in place like more accessible desks and tables and chairs. But like, it's those little everyday things that can really have like a big,
even
for construction. And like, maybe a way that the university can do that is like,
so in GRSJ, we get the lovely opportunity to do directed studies. And I know, Allison, your directed studies actually has to do with diverse ability. Do you want to kind of like explain what you're working with? Mm-hmm. It's really exciting.
So discussion of the intersection of disability, and I find this really upsetting. So I decided that I would design my own course to talk about disability. So pretty much I am just like reading a bunch of disability theory. And then, so pretty much how it works is, like, in the summer, I designed my syllabus,
mm-hmm.
and I have a professor. So I'm working with Dr. Jana Stewart, and
right.
She is awesome. She's fantastic. I designed my syllabus in the summer that has, like, a set number of readings, and pretty much each week I do my readings. And so I'm looking right now, my term paper is on the intersection of disability and motherhood.
Oh, interesting.
So, which is really interesting. So, I'm doing a lot of, like, the kind of the base level theorization of my paper. I haven't really, don't really have a thesis statement yet. No. Academic writing, you have to have a thesis statement.
Right, right.
But, like, I think the kind of the angle I'm going to take is I'm going to start off with talking about, like, just sociological ideal constructions of motherhood and, like, what is considered to be a good mother, like, fit mother, and then conversely, what's considered to be an unfit mother. And then I'm going to bring in discussion of, like, disability and motherhood. And then to further that, I'm also going to talk about how that, like, relates to other... I'm going to talk about how that relates to other constructions, such as, like, transness. So I'm going to include, like, obviously, like, all mothers, all, like, self-identified mothers. And then I'll probably bring in discussions of race and social class. But, like, what I've already done quite a bit of research. And what I've found is that it's, like, all of the papers I've read that have mothers talking about their disabilities and what it's like to be a mother with a disability is all from the basis of white women.
Right. So there's no intersectional approach, which is what you said drew you to the research in the first place.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. So I think, like, in my paper, like, I'm kind of bringing in some critical race theory, but I think kind of one of the points I'm going to make in my paper is, like, look at, like, the theory that we have right now on disability and motherhood pretty much only focuses on, like, white cis women, in that I'm going to kind of talk about the implications of that. So I'm going to, like, unpack something while I'm already unpacking something.
Right, right.
So I think it's going to be kind of a very difficult paper to write, and the fact there's a lot to consider, but I'm actually, like, I'm kind of a nerd. In the fact, I'm actually looking forward to, like, writing this paper and, like, kind of, like, ironing out my argument. And it's really clear that I'm also going to kind of bring in some discussion, some own personal discussion about, like, my relationship to disability and, like, how I want to be a mother, but, like, maybe some of the apprehensions I have.
Sorry, just one quick thing. So is that what kind of brought you to this topic? Because you said that you were interested in the intersectionality of ableism, but at the same time, what brought you to wanting to talk about motherhood? Was it just your own personal future reflections, or?
I think that's, yeah, and then, like, I remember, like, many, many years ago, when I was a little baby first year student, actually not at UBC, but at Langara College, I took, like, a Introductions to Women's Studies class, or what have you. It's called Women's Studies there. Anyways, and, like, we read one little, like, personal thought piece about, like, a woman who was a mother and had a disability, and that just, like, really stuck with me for a really long time. And I think for that class, I also wrote my final paper about, like, motherhood, and, like, I mentioned disability, and, like, I went back and, like, read it the other day. I was like, oh my god, this is, like, such a little baby first year paper. So my impetus of coming back now is to, like, I'm in, like, my fifth year of university, right? I've, like, had all this, like, theorizing under my belt, like, all this, like, and I've been, like, continuously building my academic knowledge, and I feel like it is a very kind of complex subject, and it's not really something that's, like, necessarily easy to theorize, I don't think, and now that I have, like, more theoretical knowledge and more, like, academic ability, if you will, I don't really like how that sounds, but, like, more experience with academia, that's a better way of saying, like, experience with academia, I feel more equipped to, like, deal with this topic and, like, really delve in deep, which I really don't think is something I would have had, like, the academic knowledge do 4 years ago.
Okay, so, yeah, going on that, I'm just curious about your own personal experience and understandings of diverse ability. Now that you're in your fifth year, how has it changed since you started when you were in your first year at Langara? How has your understandings of ability changed since you started? Did you find that, especially being in GRSJ, like, did you find that they changed, and in what way?
So I'm 22 now, and when I started at Langara, I was 18, I think. Yeah, I was 18. And I know it's only a few years, but, like, it seems like such a long time ago. And I think I've really changed a lot since then. I think one of the things is I wasn't at all as willing to claim the title of someone with disabilities. And, like, right, how I phrase it myself is I like to say I am someone living with disabilities, or I am someone, so I pretty much just like to phrase it like I'm someone living with disabilities, and that's just, like, a personal, I guess, like, grammatical, stylistic choice. Like, to me personally, it symbolizes that, like, my disability is only, like, a small portion of who I am, and then, like, I'm living right with them, and, like, I can kind of, they can act with my life and I interact with them, but it's not like it's something that's being enacted onto me.
Right.
If that makes sense. But I think, like, when I was, like, 18, like, fresh out of high school, like, at baby at community college, little, like, baby Allison, I don't think I was at all willing to even claim that title.
And was it largely because, was it that mentality that you were saying, that you felt that it was imposed on you, or?
I think it was, I just didn't really feel comfortable talking about it, and, like, within, like, women's studies at Langara, now just at UBC, like you said earlier, like one of the main things we learn about, like, women's studies 101, what have you, is, like, the personal is political.
Right, and, exactly.
Even at Langara, I think I was just, like, kind of new to these notions, and I wasn't really that comfortable with, like, talking about my lived experiences in relation to, like, the academia or whatever, what we learn within the program. First of all, when I was at Langara and, God, I lose my train of thought. But as I continue at Langara, now I'm at UBC and GSJ now in my last year, like, I'm really a lot more comfortable talking about all my intersections and how my different identities interact with my everyday life. And to me, I really do make that political as a person living with disabilities, as a woman, and as a queer person. I really, personally for me, it's really important to articulate those identities, because I do see it as very, very political. And in talking about my identities, I see as, like, possible to help contribute to social change. Obviously, at the same time, acknowledging the ways in which I have privilege, especially as I'm a white woman. It's really become important for me to, like, navigate my identities in the ways in which I maybe don't have privilege, but also in the ways in which I do, and kind of seeing how those interact with each other in order to make, I guess, positive.
Okay, you were just listening to Allison. Now we're going to switch over and listen to another student. Her name is Mewa, and she is an international student in her first year, or she likes to call it her fresh year at UBC. She is a double amputee who was injured in the 2008 earthquake in China, and she shared her personal experiences of her disability and coming to Vancouver to study. She has a very bright and lovely personality and a very keen interest in food, and you're going to hear that in this interview.
It's better than what I expected.
So, yeah.
Before I came here, I just feel like, oh, maybe I'll die for food, because in my province, like, we got spicy food and all spicy stuff, and I think, oh, what I'm going to do with the food here. But actually, it turns out to be great. Like, I really enjoy the food here.
Have you had any, like, cool Vancouver food since coming in?
Like, I really like the mushroom pettuccine.
Ooh, yeah. That stuff's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so going on what, like, how you're feeling about UBC, how do you feel about accessibility in UBC? Like, are you okay with accessing UBC in the different departments and getting from class to class?
Most times I find, like, the accessibility is very good. Like, compared to China, then it's way better than what is in China. But still, sometimes I find it's hard to get, like, it's frustrating to get into certain places. Like, for example, maybe Westbrook Building, it's hard to find the entrance, even though they got all the ramp and the elevator, like, the accessible equipment, but it's still hard to find the equipment.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Are there any specific kind of, like, buildings or spaces in particular that you find hard to access?
Okay, so like first one, as I said before, Westbrook Building. At first time when I tried to find the elevator, it's hard. Like it took me about 20 minutes to find the entrance. And then LSK Building is hard to find too. Even though I asked the people who study in the building, they don't know where's the basement. Like how can I get into the first floor? And then chemistry building, like to the elevator, they have a door which is not automobile. Like,
Okay,
you just cannot press the button and then open the door, and the door is very heavy. Like, mm-hmm. I can still handle it, but sometimes I'm thinking about if someone just can't use their hand.
Right.
And there's
right.
Anybody near around, so they cannot open the door probably.
Mm. Yeah. I can see why that'd be a concern. And in terms of getting into like your actual classes, like in the lecture halls, is that okay or?
Yeah, still okay. Like in UBC, we got access and diversity.
Right.
And normally it's just a suggestion, like if you need some kind of accommodation, you should go earlier, because if you just can't get into the room, you can actually ask them to change the room for you.
So, oh, okay, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And does that usually, can you do that like right on the spot, or do you have to let them know quite in advance?
Like, when you after you register for classes, you should tell them, because if the whole class is in the building already, it's so hard to change it.
Do you usually have to sit in the front of the classroom, or do you ever feel isolated by where you have to sit?
Like, I always sit in the back row because I can't get into the first row. But luckily, I still find it's okay because there are students everywhere.
Right, right.
So when you applied for university, was accessibility something you had to take into consideration?
Yeah, like the major reason for me to apply universities abroad is because I want to be independent. Like, right. I don't want to always rely on somebody, even as strangers probably. So UBC, just the accessibility is very good, I think.
Oh, awesome. Was it kind of hard? Like that's very cool. Was it very hard to think to like go out and be independent and want to apply for a university abroad? Or was it just like you were just like, I really want to go?
First, because I'm in international high school, mm-hmm. because like I'm kind of poor, and then my principal offered me the scholarship, so I studied there. And then it just gave me the chance to see the probability to study abroad. And then when I understand more, and then I feel like the accessibility and the lifestyle is better for me. Because in China, it's still kind of difficult to get around and to just enjoy my life.
Here or better in like, different ways?
Better in different ways, because yeah, I still enjoy like hot pots and the stuff in China. Yeah.
What would you say the major differences are between the accessibility here and in China?
Like the major difference is we don't get accessibility much in China. It's just like some places they got elevators, but not all places they got ramp. And I still remember once, like I was using the wheelchair by myself, and then I just get on the curb, like the ramp on the sidewalk. And then I went for about 10 minutes. And then I just see there's no way for me to get down the curb.
Right.
Like, then if there's nobody there, then you can just go back for 10 minutes again. And then just use the road that the normal cars are using.
So you got a new wheelchair. How is it? Has it made it easier for you to get around at UBC?
Like, I got a new electronic wheelchair, which is so good. Like, at first, I spent about 2 weeks here without electronic wheelchair. And it just kind of sad and, like, hard to get around because the roads are steep. And then when it's raining, it's slippery, and I cannot use normal wheelchair because my hand will get wet and the thing I'm wave will get slippery, so I just can't use wheelchair, or I just fly and gone. Now I'm using electronic wheelchair, though it's hard to sometimes to control. Like, I usually hit somebody or someplace. Now it gets less, like rarely, but it's hard to get. But then it's easy to get around with it now because you got ramp and elevators and all stuff.
Was it easy to get a wheelchair here in terms of like applying for it and financing it and having one fit for you?
I think it's not so easy to get a new electronic wheelchair here in Vancouver or in Canada as an international student.
Right.
Because for natives, like Canadians, you can get government subsidy or something.
Right.
But
right.
Electronic wheelchairs are so expensive. And actually, I just get a donation from somebody in United States to get a new one.
Was it like through a program or through a donation, like through a charity or something like
that? It's kind of charity, but it's a group that I know for a long time.
Ah, okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the group?
Yeah, it's a group that's like injured from the earthquake in 2008.
Oh, okay.
And then after the earthquake, the people in United States, like some people, they just formed a group called 12th of May, which is the day that the earthquake happened.
Right.
Like children charity group or something like that. But like sometimes they will raise money and then they will buy us computers or just help us with the things that we need help.
So they were able to help you in China, and then when you came here, they financed the wheelchair.
Yeah, they mostly just helped me like caring. Caring is better because I didn't need a lot of help in China because of my parents are taking care of me every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I guess another question I have would be is how is accessibility now there? Because I guess you just moved out, which is a big step, growing step. How has that been? How has accessibility been moving out?
Yeah, actually I'm so excited and happy. Like some people,
it's a big step.
Like doubt me like, oh, are you, like they ask me like, are your parents with you in Canada? I'm like, no, like I can't imagine how can you handle stuff by yourself. I'm like, yeah, I did it. Like, I'm so happy because the accessibility here, and I can get the chance to be independent. Like, on weekends, I always go out and buy stuff. Like sometimes I try to cook.
Ooh.
And before I came to UBC, I didn't know how to cook, and I never did cooking, and now I try to cook so many stuff, and my parents are like, did you make that? I said, yeah.
Do you ever send them pictures like, oh, look what I made?
Mostly I will send all pictures to them, show you like I'm so awesome. And then they're like, I don't believe that. Like my mother always doesn't believe that the things I can't do before, like they think if I can't do the things before, I cannot do the things later.
Mm-hmm.
And later I just show them the different things I do, like the hats I make or the food I cook and all stuff. And they're just like, I kind of admire you. But they will not tell me like in person, but they will show that I'm like so proud of myself.
Oh, nice. So I guess they had a bit of hesitance before you came here. I mean,
yeah, like before actually they were so worried like,
no,
how can you be there alone? Like, you don't know somebody, and I don't know if your English is good enough. How can you handle your stuff? Like last time when I come here, I just eat fruits every day, like mostly because I didn't know how many food here. And then now, so after I told them last time I came here, I just eat orange and bananas every day. And they said, oh, well, you survive there because of food, and or you get cold or something. But now it just turns to be great.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you're enjoying yourself here.
Yeah.
So what other, besides your wheelchair, do you use any other type of assistive technology to help you in class?
Like in class, no. But sometimes because I got a like not suitable prosthesis, so I cannot use it to go to class. But normally, sometimes once per week when I have time, then I will use the prosthesis to try to stand, so it can stretch my muscles, so I don't get so like the muscles don't get so
weak.
Yeah.
Mm. So you're saying you were using prosthesis before, but not
anymore. I use it like mostly 3 years ago, and that's my best time when I use like prosthesis. Like, I don't know why there's a difference between people using prosthesis abroad and in China. Like, we always see examples of people using prosthesis and they're walking so well. And in China, I'm a double amputee. And normally a double amputee can use prosthesis with crutches.
Right.
And when we see the examples in like probably United States or Canada, they don't use crutches. And we just don't know why. Like, we still work a lot and try to stand even though it's painful like someone, but it just doesn't make sense.
Do you think maybe it's a...
Hey guys, we're running out of time here. We're going to put this interview online available for you. Definitely worth the full listen. Mewa had a lot of very interesting things to say, and she's a very lovely person, and we will definitely be making this interview available for you online. So we're just going to end off here with All Access Pass. Just a reminder, as usual, we broadcast live from the unceded and occupied territories of the Musqueam people. Also known as UBC, we broadcast from the sub. You are listening to 101.9 CITR FM. I just want to thank everyone for listening today. I want to thank Michael Kingsmill for coming in. I want to thank Allison and Maywa as well for coming in at other times to pre-record and talk about their personal experiences being a student at UBC. With a disability, as well as Lauren and Emily, our Access Collective coordinators, Access Collective members who created the content for this week's show. Definitely go ahead, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram. If you can think of a topic or you know a topic that you want on our show, feel free to email us. Our email is accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. Tune in next week. We'll see you around. Now stick around for Synchro City with Marie.
Telling